The girl steps forward into the light of the street lamp. She appears totally different to how she did in her act. She wears a cheap-looking fake leather jacket and jeans with a hoodie underneath. But it's also that she's taken off all that thick makeup. She looks a lot less glamorous, and at the same time much more beautiful. And younger. A lot younger. I didn't get a proper look at her in the darkness near the cemetery that time. If you'd asked me, I might have guessed late 20s. But now I'd say somewhere closer to 18 or 19. The same sort of age as Mimi Meunier. "Why did you come?" she hisses at us, in that thick accent. "To the club." I remember how she turned and sprinted away the first time we met. I know I have to tread very carefully here, not spook her. "We're still looking for Ben," I say gently. "And I feel like you might know something that could help us. Am I right?" She mutters something under her breath, the word that sounds like Corva. For a moment, I think she might be about to flee, but she stays put, even steps a little closer. "Not here," she whispers. She looks behind her, nervous as a cat. "We must go somewhere else, away from this place." At her lead, we walk away from the posh streets with the fancy cars and the glitzy shop windows. We walk through avenues with red and gold fronted cafes with wicker seats outside, like the one I met Theo in. Signs advertising prefix menus. Groups of tourists still mooching about aimlessly. We leave them behind too. We walk through streets with bars and loud techno, past some sort of club with a long queue snaking around the corner. We enter a new neighborhood, where the restaurants have names written in Arabic, in Chinese, other languages I don't even recognize. We pass vape shops, phone shops that all look exactly the same. Windows of mannequins wearing different style wigs. Stores selling cheap furniture. This is not tourist Paris. We cross a traffic intersection with a bristle of flimsy-looking tents on the small patch of grass in the middle. A group of guys cooking stuff on a little makeshift stove, hands in their pockets, standing close to keep warm. The girl leads us into an all-night kebab place with a flickering sign over the door and a couple of small metal tables at the back, rows of strip lights in the ceiling. We sit down at a greasy little formica table in the corner. It's hard to imagine anywhere more different from the low-lit glamour of the club we've just left. Maybe that's exactly why she's chosen it. Theo orders us each a carton of chips. The girl takes a huge handful of hers and dunks them, all together, into one of the pots of garlic sauce, then somehow crams the whole lot hungrily into her mouth. "Who's he?" she mumbles through her mouthful, nodding at Theo. "This is Theo," I say. "He works with Ben. He's helping me. I'm Jess. What's your name?" A brief pause. "Irina." Irina. The name is familiar. I remember what Ben had scribbled on that sheet of wine accounts I found in his dictionary. "Ask Irina." "Ben said he would come back," she says suddenly, urgently. "He said he would come back for me." There's something in her expression I recognize. Aha. Someone else who has fallen in love with my brother. "He said he would get me away from that place. Help find a new job for me." "I'm sure he was working on it," I say cautiously. It sounds quite like Ben, I think. Promising things he can't necessarily deliver. But, like I said before, he's disappeared. "What has happened?" she asks. What do you think has happened to him?
We don't know, I tell her. But I found a card for the club in his stuff.
Irina, if there's anything you can tell us, anything at all, it might help us find him.
She sizes both of us up. She seems confused by being in this unfamiliar position of power. And frightened, too. Glancing over her shoulder every few seconds.
We can pay you, I say.
I look across at Theo. He rolls his eyes, pulls out his wallet. When we've agreed on an amount of cash Irina is happy with, depressingly small, actually, and after she's finished the chips and used up both of our pots of garlic sauce, she draws one leg up against the table protectively, the skin of her knee pale and bruised in one spot through the ripped denim. For some reason, this makes me think of playground scrapes, the child she was not so long ago.
You have a cigarette?
She asks Theo. He passes her one, and she lights up. Her knee is juddering against the table, so hard that the little salt and pepper shakers are leaping up and down. You were really good, by the way, I say, trying to think of something safe to begin with. You're dancing.
I know, she says, seriously, nodding her head. I'm very good. The best at La Petite Mort. I trained as a dancer before. Where I come from. When I came for the job, they said it was for dancing.
It seemed like the audience really enjoyed it, I say. The show. I thought your performance was very... I try to think of the right word. Sophisticated? She raises her eyebrows, then makes a kind of huh sound without any humor in it.
The show. She mutters. That's what Ben wanted to know about. It seemed like he knew some things already. I think someone told him some of it, maybe.
Told him some of what? I prompt. She takes a long drag on her cigarette. I notice that her hand is shaking.
That the show. All of it. It's just...
She seems to be searching for the right words.
Window. Looking. No. Window shopping? Not what that place is really about. Because afterwards, they come downstairs. The special guests.
What do you mean? Theo says, sitting forwards.
Special guests.
A nervous glance out through the windows at the street. Then suddenly she's fumbling the roll of notes Theo gave her back out of her jacket pocket, thrusting it at him.
I can't do this.
Irina, I say quickly, carefully. We're not trying to get you in any trouble. Trust me. We won't go blabbing to anyone. We're just trying to find out what Ben knew. Because I think that might help us find him. Anything you can tell us might be useful in some way. I'm really scared for him. As I say it, my voice breaks. It's no act. I lean forward, begging her. Please, please help us. She seems to be absorbing all this, deciding. I watch her take a long breath. Then, in a low voice, she begins to talk.
The special guests pay for a different kind of ticket. Rich men, important men, married men.
She holds up her hand for emphasis, touches her ring finger.
We don't know names, but we know they are important. With
She rubs her thumb and forefinger together. Money.
They come downstairs, to the other rooms, below. We make them feel good. We tell them how handsome they are, how sexy.
And do they,
Theo coughs,
buy anything?
Irina stares at him blankly. I think his delicacy might have been lost in translation.
Do they pay for sex? I ask, lowering my voice to a murmur, wanting to show we have her back.
That's what he means. Again, she glances at the windows, out at the dark street. She's practically hovering in her seat, looking like she's ready to leg it at any moment.
Do you want more money? I prompt.
I kind of want her to ask for more. I'm sure Theo can afford it.
She nods quickly.
I nudge Theo. Go on then. A little reluctantly, he pulls another couple of notes out of his pocket, slides them across the table to her. Then, almost like she's reading from some sort of script, she says,
No, it is illegal in this country to pay.
Oh. Theo and I look at each other. I think we must both be thinking the same thing. In that case, then what?
But she hasn't finished.
They don't buy that. It's clever. They buy wine. They spend big money on wine. She spreads her hands to demonstrate this. There's a code. If they ask for a younger vintage, that's the kind of girl they want. If they ask for one of the special vintages, it means they'd like extras. And we do everything they want us to. We do whatever they ask. We're theirs for the night. They choose the girl or girls they want. And they go to a special room with a lock on the door. Or we go somewhere with them. Hotel, apartment.
Ah, Theo says, grimacing.
The girls at the club. We don't have family. We don't have money. Some have run from home. Some, many, are illegal.
She sits forward.
They have our passports, too.
So you can't leave the country, I say, turning to Theo.
That's fucking dark. I can't go back there anyway, she says, suddenly, fiercely. To Serbia. It wasn't a good situation back home, she adds defensively. But I never thought that would be where I'd end up. A place like that. They know we won't go to the police. One of the clients, some girls say he is police. Important police. Other places get shut down all the time. But not that place.
Can you actually prove that? Theo asks, sitting forward.
At this, she checks over her shoulder and lowers her voice. Then she nods. I took some photos of the one they say is police.
You've got photos?
Theo leans forward, eagerly. They take our phones. But when I started speaking to Ben, he gave me a camera. I was going to give this to your brother. A hesitation. Her eyes dart between us and the window. More money, she says. Both of us turn to Theo, wait as he finds some more cash and puts it on the table between us. She fumbles her hand into the pocket of her jacket, then takes it back out. Fist clenched, knuckles showing white. Very carefully, like she's handling something explosive, she places a memory card on the table and pushes it towards me. They're not such good photos. I had to be so careful. But I think it's enough.
Yeah,
Theo says, reaching out a hand.
No,
Irina says, looking at me.
Not him.
You.
Thank you.
I take it. Slide it into my own jacket pocket.
I'm sorry,
I say, because it seems suddenly important to say it.
I'm sorry this has happened to you.
She shrugs, hunches into herself.
Maybe it's better than other things, you know? At least you're not going to end up murdered at the end of an alley, or in the Bois de Boulogne, or raped in some guy's car. We have more control. And sometimes they buy us presents to make us feel good. Some of the girls get nice clothes, jewelry. Some go on dates, become girlfriends. Everybody's happy.
Except she looks anything but happy.
There's even a story.
She leans closer, lowers her voice.
What?
Theo asks.
That the owner's wife came from there.
I stare at her.
What? From the club?
Yes.
That she was one of the girls. So I guess it worked out okay for some.
I'm trying to process this.
Sophie Meunier. The diamond earrings. The silk shirts. The icy stare. The penthouse apartment. The whole vibe of being better than everyone else. She was one of them. A sex worker.
But it's not rich husbands for everyone. Some guys, they refuse to wear anything. Or they take it off when you're not looking. Some girls get, you know, sick.
You mean STIs?
I ask.
Yes.
And then in a small voice,
I caught something.
She pulls a face, a grimace of disgust and embarrassment.
After that, I knew I had to leave. And some girls get pregnant. It happens, you know?
There's a story, too, about the girl a long, long time ago. Maybe it's just a rumor. But they say she got pregnant and wanted to keep it. Or maybe it was too late to do something. Anyway, when she went into... She mimes, doubling over with pain.
Labor.
Yes. When that happened, she came to the club. She had no other place to go. When you're illegal, you're scared to go to hospital. She had the baby in the club. But they said it was a bad birth. Too much blood. They took her body away. No one ever knows she existed. No problem. Because she wasn't official.
Jesus Christ.
And you told all this to Ben? I ask her.
Yes. He said he would make sure I was safe. Help me out.
A new start. I speak English. I'm clever. I want a normal job. Waitressing. Something like that. Because...
Her voice wavers. She puts up a hand to her eyes. I see the shine of tears.
She swipes at them with the heel of her hand, almost angrily, like she doesn't have time for crying.
It's not what I came to this country for. I came for a new life.
And even though I never cry, I feel my own eyes pricking. I hear her. Every woman deserves that. The chance of a new life.
Mimi, fourth floor. I sit here on my bed, staring into the darkness of his apartment, remembering. on his laptop 3 nights ago. I read about a place with a locked room. About what happened in that room. About the women. The men. About how it was, is, connected to this place. To this family. I felt sick to my stomach. It couldn't be right what he'd written. But there were names. There was detail, so much horrible detail. And Papa? No. It couldn't be true. I refused to believe it. It had to be lies. And then I saw my own name, like I had in his notebook, when it had been so exciting. Only now it filled me with fear. Somehow I was connected to that place too. There were horrible things my older stepbrother had said. I had always thought they were just random insults. Now I wasn't sure. I didn't think I could bring myself to read it, but I knew I had to. What I saw next, I felt my whole life fall apart. If it was true, it would explain exactly why I had always felt like an outsider. Why Papa had always treated me the way he had. Because I wasn't really theirs. And there was more. I glimpsed a line. Something about my real mother. But I couldn't read it because my eyes had blurred with tears. I froze. Then I heard footsteps outside, approaching the door. Merde. I slammed the laptop closed. The key was turning in the lock. He was back. Oh God, I couldn't face him, not now, not like this. Everything was changed between us. Broken. Everything I believed in had just been shattered. Everything I had ever known was a lie. I didn't even know who I was anymore. I ran into the bedroom. There was no time. The closet. I yanked the doors open, slipped inside, crouched down in the darkness. I heard him put a record on the player in the main room, and the music streamed out, just like the music I had heard every hot summer night, floating to me across the courtyard, as though he had been playing it for me. It felt like my heart was breaking. It couldn't be true. It couldn't be true. Then, over the sound of my own breathing, I heard him entering the room. Through the keyhole, I saw him moving around. He pulled off his sweater. I saw his stomach, that line of hair I had noticed on the first day. I thought about that girl I had been, the one who had watched him from the balcony. I hated her for being such a clueless little idiot, a spoiled brat. Thinking she had issues. She had no idea. But at the same time, I was grieving for the loss of her, knowing I could never go back to her. He paced close to the closet. I cringed back into the shadows, and then moved away again, stepping into the bathroom. I heard him turn on the shower. All I wanted now was to get out of there. This was my moment. I pushed the door open. I could hear him moving around in the bathroom, the shower door opening. I began to tiptoe across the floor, quiet as I could. Then there was a knock on the front door of the apartment. Putain! Back I ran, back to the closet, crouching down in the darkness. I heard the shower stop. I heard him go to answer it, greeting whoever it was at the door. And then I heard the other voice. I knew it straight away, of course I did. They talked for a while, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. I opened the closet door a crack, trying to hear. Then they were coming into the bedroom. Why? What were they doing in the bedroom? Why would those two come in here? I could just make them out through the keyhole. Even in those snatched glimpses, I could see there was something strange about their body language. Something I couldn't quite work out, but I knew that something was wrong. Something was not how it should be. And then it happened.
I saw them move together, the two of them. I saw their lips meet. It felt like it was happening in slow motion. I was digging my nails so hard into my palms, I thought I might be about to draw blood. This couldn't be happening. This couldn't be real. I sank down into the darkness, fist in my mouth, teeth biting into my knuckles to stop myself from screaming. A few moments later, I heard the shower start again. The two of them going into the bathroom, closing the door. Now was my chance. I didn't care about the risk that they might catch me. Now nothing mattered as much as getting out of there. I ran like I was running for my life. Back in my room, back in the apartment, I fell to pieces. I was sobbing so hard I could hardly breathe. The pain was too much, I couldn't bear it. I thought of all the plans I had made for the two of us. I knew he had felt it too, what had been between us in the park that night, and now he'd broken it, he'd ruined it all. I took out the paintings I'd made of him and forced myself to look at them. Grief became rage. Fucking bastard. Fucking lying fils de pute, all those horrible, twisted, lying words on his computer. And then he and Maman, the two of them together like that. I stopped, remembered what I'd seen on his computer. I had called her Maman. But after everything I had read, I wasn't even sure what she was to me now. No, I couldn't think about that. I couldn't believe it. It was all too painful. I could only focus on my anger. That was pure, uncomplicated. I took out my canvas cutting knife. The blade, so sharp you can cut yourself just by touching it to your thumb. I held it to the first canvas and I sliced through it. All the time I felt like he was watching me with those beautiful eyes, asking what I was doing. So I punched holes through them so I couldn't see his eyes any longer, and then I ripped into all of them, stabbing through the canvas with the blade, enjoying hearing it tear. I pulled at the fabric with my hands, the canvas rasping as his face, his body, was torn to pieces. Afterwards, I was trembling. I looked at what I'd done. The mess. The violence of it. Knowing that it had come from me, I felt like I had an electric current running through me. A feeling that was kind of like fear, kind of like excitement. But it wasn't enough. I knew what I had to do.
Jess. I have to go, Irina says, a nervous glance out at the dark, empty street beyond the windows. We've been too long, talking like this. I feel bad just letting her wander off into the city on her own. She's so young, so vulnerable. Will you be okay? I ask her. She gives me a look. It says, I've been looking after myself for a very long time, babe. I trust myself to do that better than anyone else. And there's something proud about her as she walks away. A kind of dignity. The way she holds herself, so upright. A dancer's posture, I suppose. I think how Ben promised to take care of her. I could make promises too, but I don't know if I can keep them. I don't want to lie to her. But I make a vow to myself, in this moment, that if I can find a way, I will. As Theo and I walk towards the metro, I'm reeling, running through everything Irina told us. Do they all know? The whole family, Even nice guy Nick. The thought makes me feel nauseous. I think of how he told me that he was between jobs, how it clearly didn't make much odds to him. I suppose it wouldn't if you don't need an income, if your lifestyle is being bankrolled by a load of girls selling themselves. And if the Meunier family knew that Ben had found out the truth about Le Petit Moor, what might they have done to prevent a secret like that from getting out? I turned to Theo. If Ben's story had been printed, the police would have to act, wouldn't they? It wouldn't matter if the Meunier have some high-up contacts. Surely there'd be public pressure to investigate. Theo nods, but I sense he's not really listening. So he really was onto something, after all, he mutters quickly, almost to himself. He sounds very different to his usual, sardonic, downbeat self. He sounds... I try to put my finger on it. Excited. I glance at him. It's going to be a huge scoop, he says. It's big. It's really big. Especially if establishment figures are involved. It's like the President's Club, but way, way darker. It's the sort of thing that wins awards. I stop dead. Are you taking the piss? I can feel anger pulsing through me. Do you even care about Ben at all? I stare at him. You don't, do you? Theo opens his mouth to say something, but I don't want to hear another word. Oh, you know what? Fuck you! I march away from him, as fast as I can in these ridiculous heels. I'm not completely sure where I'm going, and of course my stupid phone ran out of data, but I'll work it out. Far better than having to spend literally another second in his company. Jess! Theo calls. I'm half jogging now. I turn left onto another street. I can't hear him anymore. Thank God. I think this is the way. But the problem is that all the crappy phone shops look exactly the same, especially with their lights off and grills down. No one about. There's an odd smell coming from somewhere. Acrid. Like burning plastic. What a bastard. I seem to be crying. Why the hell am I crying? I always knew I couldn't trust him, really. I suspected he'd had some angle the first time we met. So it's not like it's a big surprise. It must be everything. The stress of the last few days. Or Irina. The horror of everything she just told us. Or simply the fact that, even though I half saw it coming, I'd kind of hoped I was wrong. Just this once. And now here I am alone. Again. Like always. I turn onto a new street. Hesitate. I don't think I recognize this. But there seem to be metro stops everywhere in this city. If I walk for another couple of blocks, I'm sure I'll find one. Over the churn of angry thoughts in my head, I'm vaguely aware of some sort of commotion nearby. Yelling and shouting. A street party? Maybe I should head in that direction. Because I've just realized there's a lone guy walking in my direction from the other end of the street. Hands in his pockets. And I'm sure he's fine. But I don't really want to test it. I turn off, head towards the noise. And way, way too late, I realize this is no street party. I see a mass of people surging in my direction. Some of them wearing balaclavas and swim goggles and ski masks. Huge plumes of black smoke are mushrooming into the air. I can hear screaming, shouting, the sound of metal being struck. Heat roars towards me in a powerful wave, and I see the fire in the middle of the street. The flames as high as the second floor windows of the buildings opposite. In the middle you can just make out the blackened skeleton of a police van that has been turned on its side and set ablaze. Now I can make out the police approaching the protesters in riot gear, helmets and plastic visors, waving batons in the air. I hear the whiplash crack of the batons as they make contact. And mixing with the black smoke is another kind of vapour. Greyish, spilling in all directions, coming towards me. For a moment I stand, frozen, watching. People are running in this direction, slaloming around me, pushing, yelling, desperate, holding scarves and t-shirts over their mouths. A guy next to me turns and lobs something, a bottle, back in the direction of the police. I turn and follow, trying to run. But there are too many bodies, and the grey vapour is catching up with me, swirling all around. I start coughing and can't stop. I feel like I'm choking. My eyes are stinging, watering so much I can hardly see. Then I collide, smack, into another body. Someone who's just standing still in the middle of the stampede. I ricochet back, winded by the impact. Then look up, squinting through the tears. Theo! He grabs hold of the arm of my jacket, and I cling onto him. Together we turn and half run, half stumble, coughing and wheezing. Somehow we find a side street, manage to break free from the torrent of people. A few minutes later, we shove through the door of a nearby bar. My eyes are still streaming. I look at Theo and see his eyes are red-rimmed too.
Tear gas, he says, putting his forearm up to rub at them. Fuck.
People are turning on their bar stools to stare at us.
We need to wash this stuff out of our eyes, Theo says. Straight away.
The barman points us wordlessly in the right direction. It's a single, largish bathroom. We get the tap running and splash water onto our faces, leaning together over the small sink. I can hear ragged breathing. I'm not sure if it's mine or his. I blink. The water has helped to ease the stinging a little. It's now, as my pulse returns to normal, that I remember. I don't want to be in this guy's company at all. I grope for the door.
Jess, Theo says. About before.
No. Nope. Fuck off.
Please, hear me out.
He does, at least. Look a little ashamed. He puts up a hand, mops his eyes. The fact that the tear gas makes him look like he's been crying is an odd addition. He starts speaking, quickly, like he's trying to get it all out before I can cut him off.
Please, let me explain. Look, this job is a total pain in the arse. It pays absolutely nothing. It broke up my last relationship. Every so often, something like this comes along, and you get to expose the bear guys, and suddenly it all seems worthwhile. Yeah, I realise that's no excuse. I got carried away. I'm sorry.
I look down at the floor, my arms crossed.
And if I'm truthful, no, I don't really care about your brother. One key skill as a journalist is being able to read people. And can I be really brutally honest now? Ben always seemed totally self-interested. Always out for numero uno. I hate him for saying it. Not least because there's a part of me that suspects he may be right.
How dare you?
No. No. Let me speak. When he initially told me about his big scoop, I was skeptical.
He's also a bit of a bullshit merchant, no? But when you played me that voicemail, I thought, yeah, actually there might be a story here. Maybe he did get tangled up in something nasty. It might be worth seeing where this all leads after all. So no, I didn't care about your brother. But you know what, Jess? I want to help you.
Oh, fuck.
No, listen. I want to help you because I think you deserve a break. And I think you're pretty bloody brave. And I also think you don't have a bad bone in your body.
Then you really don't know me at all.
Christ, does anyone really know anyone? I'm not a bad guy, Jess. To be fair, I'm not an entirely good one, either. But, he coughs, looks down at the floor. I glance at him. Is he bullshitting me? My eyes have started streaming again. I really don't want him to think they're tears.
Ow, Jesus.
I wince as I rub at them. He steps towards me. Hey, can I take a look? I shrug. He reaches out a hand and tilts my chin upwards. Yeah, they're still pretty red. But I think we only got a little of it, thank God. It should wear off soon. His face is very close to mine. And I'm not quite sure how it happens. But one moment he's holding my jaw and peering at me, his touch surprisingly gentle. The next I appear to be kissing him, and he tastes like cigarettes and wine from the club, which is suddenly one of the better tastes I can imagine. And he's a lot taller than me, so my neck is cricked. But actually I don't care. In fact, I kind of like it, because this is hot. It's really fucking hot. And also wrong in so many different ways. Not least because I'm wearing his ex-girlfriend's clothes. And even though he's so much bigger than me, I'm the one pushing him back against the sink, and he's letting me, and one of his big hands is tangling in my hair. And then I'm taking his other hand and pulling it under this stupid, tiny dress. And it's only now that we remember we should probably lock the door.
Sophie, penthouse. The others have left the penthouse. I sent Mimi to her apartment to wait. I don't want her to witness any of what's to come. My daughter is so fragile. Our relationship, too. We have to find a new way of being with one another. I walk into the bathroom, gaze at myself in the mirror, grip the sides of the sink. I look pale and drawn. I look every one of my 50 years. If Jacques were here right now, he would be appalled. I smooth my hair. I spray scent behind my ears, on the pulse points of my wrists, powder the shine off my forehead. Then I pick up my lipstick and apply it. My hand falters only once. Otherwise, I am as precise as ever. Then I walk back to the main room of the apartment. The bottle of wine is still there on the table. Another glass, just to help me think. I start, as I realize I am not alone. Antoine stands by the floor-to-ceiling windows, watching me. A malignant presence. He must have stayed behind after the other two left. What are you doing here? I ask him. I try to keep my voice controlled, even though my pulse is fluttering up somewhere near my throat. He steps forward under the spotlights. The mark of my hand is still pink on his cheek. I'm not proud of myself for that loss of restraint. It happens so rarely. I've become good at keeping my emotions in check over the years. But on those very rare occasions when the provocation is great enough, I seem to lose all sense of proportion. The rage takes over.
It's been fun, he says, coming nearer still.
What has been fun? Oh. The grin he gives me now makes him look quite deranged.
But surely you have guessed by now. After that whole thing with the photograph in Papa's study, you know? leaving those little notes for you in your postbox under your door, waiting to collect my cash. I really do like how you package it up like that for me. Those nice cream envelopes. Very discreet. I stare at him. I feel as though everything has just been turned on its head. You! It's been you all along! He gives a little mock curtsy. Are you surprised that I got it together enough? A useless hothouse flower like me? I even managed to keep it all to myself up till now. Didn't want my darling brother to try and get in on the action too, because, as you well know, he is just as much of a... what was the word you used again? Leech, as I am. He's just more hypocritical about it. Hides it better. You don't need money, I tell him. Your father, that's what you think. But you see, I had an inkling a few weeks ago that Dominique might be about to try and leave. Just as I suspected, she's trying to fleece me for everything I've got. She's always been a greedy little bitch. And darling Papa is so fucking tight-fisted. So I wanted a little extra cash, you know, to squirrel away. Did Jacques tell you? No. I worked it all out on my own. I found the records. Papa keeps very precise notes, did you know that? Of the clients, but also of the girls. I always had my suspicions about you, but I wanted proof. So I went deep into the archives. I found the details of one Sofia Volkova, who used to work, he puts the word in air quotes, at the club nearly 30 years ago. That name. But Sofia Volkova no longer exists. I left her back there, shut up in that place with the staircase leading deep underground, the velvet walls, the locked room. Anyway, Antoine says, I'm more switched on than people realize. I see a great deal more than everyone thinks. That manic grin again. But then you knew that part already, didn't you?
Jess. Theo and I walked to the metro together. Funny how after you've slept with someone, not that you'd call what we just did up against the sink sleeping, you can suddenly feel so shy, so unsure of what to say to each other. I feel stupid, thinking about the time we might have just wasted. Even if, admittedly, neither of us took that much time. It also feels almost like it just happened to someone else. Especially now I've changed back into my normal clothes. Theo turns to face me, his expression solemn. Jess, you obviously can't go back to that place. Back into the belly of the beast. You'd be bloody mad. His tone no longer has that drawling, sardonic edge to it. There's a softness there. Don't take this the wrong way, but you strike me as the kind of person who could be a little reckless. I know you probably think it's the only way you can help Ben, and it's really commendable. I stare at him. Commendable. I'm not trying to win some kind of bloody school prize. He's my brother. He's literally the only family I have in the entire world. Okay, Theo says, putting his hands up. That was clearly the wrong word. But it's way, way too dangerous. Why don't you come to mine? I have a couch. You'd still be in Paris. You'll be able to keep looking for Ben. You could speak to the police. What? The same police who supposedly know about that place and haven't done anything about it? The same police who might well actually be in on it? Yeah. Bat lot of good that would do. We head down the steps to the metro together, down onto the platform. It's almost totally empty. Just some drunk guy singing to himself on the opposite side. I hear the deep rumble of a train approaching. Feel it behind my breastbone. Then I have a sudden, definite feeling that something is wrong. Though I can't work out what. A kind of sixth sense,
I suppose. Then I hear something else. The sound of running feet. Several pairs of running feet.
Theo,
I say. Look, I think... But before I've even got the words out, it's happening. Four big guys are tackling Theo to the ground. I realize that they're in uniform, police uniforms, and one of them is triumphantly holding a baggie full of something white in the air.
That's not mine, Theo shouts. You planted that on me! Fuck's sake!
But his next words are muffled, then replaced by a groan of pain, as one policeman slams his face into the wall, while another clips cuffs on him. The train is pulling into the platform. I see the people in the nearest carriage staring from the windows. Then I see that another man is approaching us on the platform. Older, wearing a smart suit beneath an equally smart grey coat. That cropped steel grey hair. That pit bull face. I know him. It's the guy Nick took me into the police station to meet. Commissaire Blanchot. Now, thinking wildly back, I make another connection. The figure I thought I recognized in the audience at the club, just before the lights went down. It was him. He must have been following us all night. The two policemen, who aren't so preoccupied with holding Theo, start towards me now. It's my turn. I know I only have a few seconds to act. The train doors are opening. Suddenly, a whole crowd of protesters are pouring from the carriage, carrying signs and makeshift weapons. Theo manages to turn his head towards me.
Jess!
He calls through a split lip, his voice slurred.
Get on the bloody train!
The guy behind him knees him in the back. He crumples onto the platform. I hesitate. I can't just leave him here.
Get on the fucking train, Jess. I'll be fine. And don't you dare go back there.
The nearest policeman lunges for me. I step quickly out of his way, then turn and shove my way through the oncoming crowd. I leap up into the carriage just before the doors close.
Sophie, penthouse.
Well,
Antoine says, much as I have enjoyed our little chit-chat, I'd like my cash now, please. He puts out his hand. I thought I'd come and collect it in person, because I've been waiting for 3 days now. You've always been so prompt in the past, so diligent. And I've let a day go by for extenuating circumstances, you know. But I can't wait forever. My patience does have limits. I don't have it, I say. It is not as easy as you think. I think it's pretty fucking easy. Antoine gestures about at the apartment. Look at this place. I unclasp my watch and hand it to him. Fine. Take this. It's a Cartier Panthère. I'll tell your father it is gone for mending.
Oh, mais non.
He puts up a hand, mock affectedly. I'm not getting my hands dirty. I'm Papa's son, after all. You must know that about me, surely. I would like another pretty cream-colored envelope of cash, please. It's so very like you, isn't it? The elegant exterior, the cheap, grubby reality inside. What have I done to make you hate me so much? I ask him. I've done nothing to you. Antoine laughs.
You're telling me that you really don't know?
He leans in a little closer, and I can smell the stink of the alcohol on his breath.
You are nothing. Nothing compared to Maman. She was from one of the best families in France. A truly great French line, proud, noble. You know the family thinks he killed her. Paris's best physicians, and they couldn't work out what was making her so sick. And when she died, he replaced her with what? With you? To be honest, I didn't need to see those records. I knew what you were from the moment I met you. I could smell it on you.
My hand itches to slap him again, but I won't allow another loss of control. Instead, I say, Your father will be so disappointed in you.
Oh, don't try with the disappointment card. It doesn't work for me any longer. He's been disappointed in me ever since I came out of my poor mother's shat. And he's given me fucking nothing. Nothing. Anyway, it hasn't been tied up with guilt and recrimination. All he's given me is his love of money and the fucking Oedipal complex.
If he hears about this, you threatening me, he'll cut you off.
Except he won't hear about it, will he? You can't tell him because that's the whole point. You can't let him find out because there's so much I could tell. Other things that have gone on inside these apartment walls.
He pulls a thoughtful expression. How does that saying go again?
Quand le chien n'est pas là, les souris dansent.
While the cat's away, the mice dance. He takes out his phone, waves it back and forth in front of my face. Jacques' number, right there on the screen. You wouldn't do it, I say, because then you wouldn't get your money.
Well, isn't that exactly the point? Chicken and egg, ma chère belle-mère.
You pay, I don't tell. And you really don't want me to tell Papa, do you? About what else I know? He leers at me, just as he did when I left the third floor apartment one evening, and he emerged out of the shadows on the landing. Looked me up and down in a way that no stepson should look at their stepmother.
Your lipstick, ma chère belle-mère, he said with a nasty smile. It's smudged. Just there.
No, I tell Antoine now. I'm not going to give you any more.
Excuse me?
He cups a hand behind his ear. I'm sorry, I don't understand. No, you're not getting your money. I'm not going to give it to you. He frowns.
But I'll tell my father. I'll tell him the other thing.
Oh, no, you won't. I know that I am in dangerous territory, but I can't resist saying it, calling his bluff. He nods at me slowly, like I'm too stupid to understand him.
I assure you, I absolutely will.
Fine. Message him now. I see a spasm of confusion cross his face.
You stupid bitch,
he spits.
What's wrong with you?
But suddenly he seems uncertain.
Even afraid.
I told Benjamin Daniels about Sofia Volkova. That was my most reckless act. More than anything else I did with him. We'd showered together that afternoon. He had washed my hair for me. Perhaps it was this simple act, far more intimate than the sex in its way, that released something in me, that encouraged me to tell him about the woman I thought I had left behind in a locked room beneath one of the city's better-heeled streets. In doing so, I felt suddenly as though I was the one in control. Whoever my blackmailer was, they would no longer hold all of the cards. I would be the one telling the story. Jacques chose me, I said. He could have had his pick of the girls, but he chose me.
But of course he chose you,
Ben said, as he traced a pattern on my naked shoulder. He was flattering me, perhaps. But over the years I had also come to see what the attraction must have been for my husband. Far better to have a second wife who could never make him feel inferior, who came from somewhere so far beneath him that she would always be grateful. Someone he could mold as he chose. And I was so happy to be molded, to become Madame Sophie Meunier with her silk scarves and diamond earrings. I could leave that place far behind. I wouldn't end up like some of the others, like the poor wretch who had given birth to my daughter. Or so I thought, until that first note showed me that my past hung over my life like a blade, ready at any moment to pierce the illusion I had created.
And tell me about Mimi.
Ben murmured into the nape of my neck.
She's not yours, is she? How does she fit into all this?
I went very still. This was his big mistake, the thing that finally shocked me out of my trance. Now I knew I wasn't the only one he was speaking to. Now I realized how stupid I had been, stupid and lonely and weak. I had revealed myself to this man, this stranger, someone I still didn't really know, in spite of all our snatched time together. In hindsight, perhaps even as he told me about his childhood, he had been selecting, editing, part of him slipping away from me, ever unknowable, giving me choice morsels, just enough that I would unburden myself to him in return. He was a journalist, for God's sake. How could I have been so foolish? In talking, I had handed him the power. I hadn't just risked everything I had built for myself, my own way of life. I'd risked everything I wanted for my daughter, too. I knew what I had to do, just as I know what I have to do now. I steel myself, give Antoine my most withering stare. He may be taller than me, but I feel him cringing beneath it. I think he has just understood that I am beyond bullying. Message your father or not, I say. I don't care. But either way, you aren't getting another euro from me. And at this moment, I think we all have more important matters to focus on. Don't you? You know Jacques' position on this. The family comes first.
Jess. I'm back here. Back in this quiet street with its beautiful buildings. That familiar feeling settles over me. The rest of the city, the world, seems so far away. I think of Theo's words. You strike me as the kind of person who could be a little reckless. It made me angry when he said it, but he was right. I know there is a part of me that is drawn to danger, even seeks it out. Maybe it's madness. Maybe if Theo hadn't just been arrested, I'd have gone back to his like he said I should, crashed on his sofa. Maybe not. But as it stands, I don't have anywhere else to go. I know I can't go to the police. I also know that if I want to find out what happened to Ben, this place is the only option. The building holds the key. I'm sure of it. I won't find any answers running away. I had a gut feeling that day with Mum, too. She was acting weirdly that morning. Wistful. Not herself. Her smile dreamy, like she was already somewhere else. Something told me I shouldn't go to school. Fake a sick note, like I had before. But she wasn't sad or frightened. Just a little checked out. And it was sports day. And once upon a time I was good at sport. And it was summer. And I didn't want to be around Mum when she was like that. So I went to school and completely forgot Mum even existed for a few hours. But anything existed except my friends and the three-legged race and the sack race and all that stupid stuff. When I got home at 3:50, I knew. Before I even got to the bedroom, before I even unpicked that lock and opened that door. I think maybe she'd changed her mind. Remembered she had kids who needed her more than she needed to leave. Because she wasn't lying peacefully on the bed. She was lying like a snapshot of someone doing a front crawl. Frozen in the act of swimming towards the door. I'll never ignore a gut feeling again. If they've done something to Ben, I know I've got the best chance of finding it out. Not the police in their pay. No one but me. I've got nothing to lose, really. If anything, I feel a kind of pull towards this place now. To crawl, as Theo put it, back into the belly of the beast. I'd thought it sounded melodramatic when he said it, but when I stand at the gate and look up at it, it feels right. Like this place, this building, is some huge creature ready to swallow me whole. There's no sign of anyone about when I enter the apartment building, not even the concierge. All the lights are off in the apartments up above. It seems as deathly quiet as it did the night I arrived. It's late, I suppose. I tell myself it must just be my imagination that lends the silence a heavy quality, like the building has been waiting for me. I move towards the stairwell. Strange. Something draws my eye to the dim light. A large, untidy pile of clothes at the bottom of the stairs, strewn across the carpet. What on earth is that doing there? I reach for the light switch. The lights stutter on. I look back at the pile of old clothes. My stomach clenches. I still can't see what it is, but in an instant I know. I just know. Whatever is there at the bottom of the stairs is something bad. Something I don't want to see. I move towards it as though I'm pushing through water, resisting, and yet knowing I have to go and look. As I get closer, I can make it out more clearly. There's a solid shape visible inside the softness of the material. Oh my God. I'm not sure if I whisper this out loud, or if it's only in my head. I can see now with horrible clarity that the shape is a person. Lying face down, spread-eagled on the flagstones. Not moving. Definitely not moving. Not again. I've been here before. The body in front of me so horribly still. Oh my God. Oh my God. I can see little spots dancing in front of my eyes. Breathe, Jess. Just breathe. Every part of me wants to scream, to run in the opposite direction. I force myself to crouch down. There's a chance she could still be alive. I bend down, put out a hand, touch the shoulder. I can feel bile rising in my throat, gagging me. I swallow hard. I roll the concierge over. Her body moves as though it really is just a loose collection of old clothes, too fluid. Too senseless. A couple of hours ago, she was warning me to be careful. She was frightened. Now she's... I put a couple of fingers to her neck. Sure, there'll be nothing. But I think I feel something. Is that... Yes. Beneath my fingertips. A stuttering. A pulse. Faint but definite. She is still alive, but only just. I look up at the dark stairwell, towards the apartments. I know this wasn't an accident. I know one of them did this. Jess. Can you hear me? Christ. I realise I don't even know the woman's name. I'm going to call an ambulance. It seems so pointless. I'm sure she can't hear me. But as I watch her lips begin to part, as though she's trying to say something, I reach into my pocket for my phone. But there's nothing there. My jacket pocket is empty. What the hell? I scrabble in my jeans pocket. Not in there either. Back up to my jacket. But it's definitely not here. No phone. And then I remember. I handed it over to that doorman in the club, because he wouldn't let us in otherwise. We got thrown out before I had a chance to collect it. And I'm certain he wouldn't have handed it over anyway. I close my eyes. Take a deep breath. Okay, Jess, think. Think. It's fine. It's fine. You don't need your phone. You can just go onto the street and ask someone else to call an ambulance. I shove open the door, run through the courtyard to the gate, pull at the handle. But nothing happens. I pull harder. Still nothing. It doesn't move a millimeter. The gate is locked. It's the only explanation. I suppose the same mechanism that allows it to be opened with the key code can also be used to lock it shut. I'm trying to think rationally, but it's difficult because panic is taking over. The gate is the only way out of this place, and if it's locked, then I'm trapped inside. There is no way out. Could I climb it? I look up, hopefully. But it's just a sheet of steel. Nothing to get a toehold on. Then there are the anti-climb spikes along the top, and the shards of glass along the wall either side that would shred me to pieces if I tried to climb over. I run back into the building, into the stairwell. When I return, I see the concierge has managed to sit up, her back against the wall near the bottom of the staircase. Even in the gloom, I can make out the cut at her hairline, where she must have hit her head on the stone floor.
"No ambulance,"
she whispers, shaking her head at me.
"No ambulance. No police."
"Are you mad? I have to call..." I break off, because she has just looked up at the staircase behind me. I follow her gaze. Nick is standing there, at the top of the first flight of stairs.
"Hello, Jess," he says. "We need to talk."
Nick, second floor.
"You animal," she says. "You did this to her. Who the fuck are you?"
I put up my hands. It wasn't me. I just found her." It was Antoine, of course, going too far as usual. An old woman, for God's sake, to shove her like that.
"It must have been a terrible accident. Look, there are some things I have to explain. Can we talk?" "No," she says. "No, I don't want to do that, Nick."
"Please, Jess, please. You have to trust me." I need her to stay calm. Not do anything rash. Not force me to do something I'll regret. I'm also still unsure whether or not she has a phone on her.
"Trust you? Like I trusted you before? When you took me to meet that shady cop? When you hid from me that you were a family?"
"Look, Jess," I say, "I can explain everything. Just come with me. I don't want you to get hurt. I really don't want anyone else to get hurt."
"What?"
She gestures to the concierge.
"Like her? And Ben? What have you done to Ben? He's your friend, Nick! No!"
I shouted. I've been trying to be so calm, so controlled. "He was not my friend. He was never my friend. And I don't even try to keep the bitterness at bay. 3 nights ago, my little sister Mimi came and told me what she had found on his computer. It said, 'Our money doesn't come from wine.' It says it's girls. Men buying girls, not wine. This horrible place, this club. Ce n'est pas vrai. It can't be true, Nick. Tell me it's not true." She was sobbing as she tried to speak. "And it says..." She fought for breath. "It says I'm not really theirs." I suppose we always knew about Mimi, Antoine and I. I suppose all families have these kinds of secrets, these commonly agreed deceptions that are never spoken of aloud. Frankly, we were too afraid. I remember how, when we were little more than kids, Antoine made some comment that our father overheard, some insinuation. Papa backhanded him across the room. It has never properly been mentioned again, just another skeleton thrown into the back of the closet. Ben had clearly been very, very busy.
It sounded as though he had discovered more about Papa and his business than I even knew myself. But then I haven't wanted to know all the deplorable particulars. I've kept as much distance, as much ignorance as possible over the years. Still, it was all tied up with a thing I had told him in strictest confidence 10 years before in a weed cafe in Amsterdam. The confession he had promised me hand on heart never to share with another soul. The secret at the very heart of my family. My main, terrible source of shame. I can still remember my father's words when I was 16, outside that locked door at the bottom of the velvet staircase, taunting. "Oh, you think this is something you can just turn your nose up at, do you? You think you're above this? What do you think really paid for that expensive school? What do you think paid for the house you live in, the clothes you wear? Some dusty old bottles? Your sainted mother's precious inheritance? No, my boy. This is where it comes from. Think you're immune now? Think you're too good for all of it?" I knew all too well what Mimi had felt, reading about it on Ben's computer, learning about the roots of our wealth, our identity, discovering it was sullied money that had paid for everything. It's like a disease. A cancer spreading outwards and making all of us sick. But at the same time, you can't choose your blood. They are still the only family I have. When Mimi told me what she had read, all of it, Ben's casual text message months ago, our meeting in the bar, the move into this building, suddenly revealed itself to be not the workings of happy coincidence, but something far more calculated, targeted. He had used me to fulfill his own ambitions, and now he would destroy my family. And in the process, he apparently didn't care that he would also destroy me. I thought again of that old French saying about family. La voix du sang est la plus forte. The voice of blood is the strongest. I didn't have a choice. I knew what I had to do. Just as I know what I have to do now.
Jess.